Monster Man, Episode 80, Babbler to Burbling. Stop hitting the Monster Man, it was a bad plan, but I had to get to town on it. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and in this second season of Monster Man, I'm reading my way through the 1981 Fiend Folio Supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, and as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in it, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're starting with a mutant lizard man, working our way through a great big old bat, and finishing up with a creature from Filipino folklore. But before we do that, let's take a look at some listener mail. Bob Faulkner wrote an email about the most recent episode, which included the assassin bug. And Bob points out that there is, in fact, a real insect called the assassin bug, and that it's not very similar to the assassin bug in the Fiend Folio. And this is a bit strange, because the real-world assassin bug is absolutely horrifying. Bob says, "This is like the weirdest monster adaptation ever, because it has, from the illustration, the appearance of a fly. In behavior, it's clearly a wasp, but it takes its name from a genuinely creepy, horrific bug. There are actually several types of real assassin bugs, and they all have different interesting notes. But the main thing to know is they all have this huge proboscis that they use to liquefy insects or to pierce the flesh of mammals and birds. One type of assassin bug is the kissing bug, which is a vampire and a contagious spreader of the disease Chagas. But it's super creepy because, unlike ticks and mosquitoes, the kissing bug is only interested in sucking blood from around the lips and the eyelids. Another is the Acanthaspis petax, which doesn't have a separate common name as far as I can tell, which kills ants, but it doesn't eat them. It wears their husks like a form of camouflage while it goes out and hunts other insects. Bob linked me to an article about this insect, which indeed shows it with a big pile of ant carapaces on its back, and apparently what this means is that the camouflage of the dead ants messes up the bug's profile, so it doesn't, the jumping spiders, which are its primary predator, don't, or at least have a harder time recognizing it for what it is when it's got all this stuff on its back. He says, so to me it's an odd choice to have them steal the behavior of a parasitic wasp, which is undoubtedly nightmarish, and I've used a good effect several times in the past. The assassin bug could have been a 6-foot-tall insect that wears the skin of the things it kills, and lures its prey into this vampiric embrace where it sucks at their insides. A really good horror mystery monster with this kind of twist ending where it either emerges from its disguise like something out of The Fly, or the players attempt to fight what they think is a vampire, only to finally subdue it and discover it was this lurking chitinous nightmare all along." See, that's interesting. I mean, I wonder if they just designed the creature based on the fact that assassin bug is a cool name. But as we'll see over the next couple of episodes, this is not going to be our last kind of mainly ecological monster from the pen of Ian Livingston. Next, before we get started with the monsters, it's time to thank a new Patreon backer. This is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 a month to support the show. And if, like today's patron, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get access to my new podcast. Well, I guess I shouldn't say new. It's only 16 episodes now. I say that every time, don't I? But anyway, you'll get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I do, for the Deities and Demigods book, what I've been doing for the Fiend Folio, only a little bit more in depth. So thank you very much to Chris at the Study. Chris, your support for the show is greatly appreciated. All right, let's take a look at some monsters. Our first monster is the Babbler, created by Jeremy Goodwin and Ian McDowell. And the Babbler is kind of an unusual creature. It's sort of, every so often, the Fiend Folio's composite nature, and you got this in the Monster Manual as well, means that alphabetization produces two very similar monsters which are quite close to each other within the book. And this is the case here with the Babbler and another dinosaur-like creature, the Bone Snapper. The Babbler is basically a big mutant lizard man, which has the appearance of a kind of Gorgosaurus. Sometimes it walks on four legs like a crocodile, sometimes it stands up and fights on its hind legs, and all the time that it does, it gibbers to itself in a kind of, I think they use the term quasi-lingual, you know, mutter. And it can kind of understand speech, so it's relatively intelligent. I mean, not intelligent like you'd ask it for help with your homework, but intelligent by the standards of a dinosaur. And it said that they are swamp inhabitants. So, I guess it's kind of like, a, you know, your usual swamp lizard encounter, but with this sort of element of the grotesque and absurd added to it. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous, but also it's kind of horrible. Like, a single unexplained behavior can turn a more or less normal wilderness encounter into something memorable and terrifying.
And I do like the idea that babblers are mutant lizard men, right? So there are, you know, so there are these villages of lizard men in the swamp. And of course, lizard men could be a dangerous opponent, but also they're frightened of these degenerate mutant creatures that they know were once lizard men or descended from lizard men that live out in the swamp babbling to themselves in a crude parody of language. But nonetheless, it is a little dinosaur, and therefore it's kind of similar to the Bone Snapper, which we're going to be talking about in a couple of episodes. And that's really its downside. It's just another swamp lizard monster. It just has this weird gimmick, but the gimmick doesn't really mean anything. It's just atmospheric. I think I could definitely make good use of a babbler, and it is one of those monsters that does go well in the kind of like a swamp, not a swamp that's just a wetland environment, but a swamp that is a creepy place, you know, a horror swamp where the, you know, moss drips from the trees and there are like ramshackle cabins everywhere full of strange swamp folk who might kill you. Next, we have the Bat, Giant, created by none other than Lewis Pulsifer. And the Bat, Giant is, like a lot of other giant animals in early Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, it's not that giant. It has a 5 to 6 foot wingspan. This puts it right about in line with the largest actual bat species, the giant golden-crowned flying fox, which has a wingspan of, you know, about 5 to 6 feet. Or up to 5 to 6 feet, anyway. Now, of course, like other flying fox species, the giant golden-crowned flying fox is not aggressive. It's a fruit bat, whereas the Bat, Giant is a carnivorous bat. Interesting to me that it's not a vampire bat, right? I mean, it seems like when you have a horror bat, it's probably a vampire bat, and this is definitely some Castlevania type of stuff, right? But the Bat, Giant is a strong utility monster. You know, they could be in a cave, or they could be hanging from the eaves of a vampire's castle, or they could be being ridden around on by very small antagonists like pixies or pukas or whatever. I think there's a lot of room for the use of the Bat, Giant, and this may be Lou Pulsifer just kind of filling in a perceived gap in the monster manual, right? Giant bats are certainly the kind of thing that you would come up with to populate a dungeon or evil castle, but there are no stats for them in the monster manual, so the Fiend Folio helpfully provides them. It's not going to set the world on fire, but it is a good, solid, atmospheric wildlife encounter monster, and I do like the idea of having little guys ride on them. You know, imps or something could ride on the back of giant bats. But finally, we come to the real treat of this episode. I'm talking about the Burbalang, created by Albi Fiore, or Fior, as the case may be, with, once again, great art by Russ Nicholson. I said earlier in this episode that the Burbalang is a creature from Filipino folklore, and it's true that there is, maybe, a creature in Filipino folklore called a Burbalang, more on that anon, but they're not exactly the same as the Burbalang as described here in the Fiend Folio. So let me tell you a little bit about the Burbalang. As far as I know, the only written reference to the Burbalang as a piece of Filipino folklore comes from an article published in 1896 in volume 65, part 3, number 1, of the Journal of the Asiatic Society of Bengal. It's called Cagayan Sulu, Its Customs, Legends, and Superstitions, and is by the delightfully named Ethelbert Forbes Skirchley, who I believe was a British naval officer who happened to be in the Philippines. And he wrote a whole article about this part of the Philippines. This is one of the southern islands down toward kind of Malaysia. And he wrote about its folklore and things. And part of this involves talking about the Burbalang. And the great thing about Ethelbert Forbes Skirchley's Burbalang story is that it starts out as a sort of ethnographic tale about what the people in this island believe. And then it turns into a legit ghost story. So I really don't know what better to do than to just read you part of this article by Ethelbert Forbes Skirchley. And if I remember, I'm going to put up a link to it in the show notes as well. All right, so imagine that we've pulled up a table in the club and the fans are lazily beating the tropic air, and I poured myself my third or fourth gin and tonic of the night, and I'm going to regale you sweatingly with this tale of peril. In the center of the island is a small village, the inhabitants of which owe allegiance to neither of the two chiefs. These people are called Burbalangs, and the Cagayans live in great fear of them. These Burbalangs are ghouls, and must eat human flesh occasionally, or they would die. You can always tell them because the pupils of their eyes are not round, but just narrow slits like those of a cat. They dig open the graves and eat the entrails of the corpses, but in Cagayan the supply is limited. So when they feel the craving for a feed of human flesh, they go away into the grass, and having carefully hidden their bodies, hold their breath and fall into a trance. Their astral bodies are then liberated in the form of heads with the feet attached to the ears as wings. They fly away, and entering the house make their way into the body of one of the occupants, and feed on his entrails, when of course he dies in fearful agony. The burblangs may be heard coming, as they make a moaning noise which is loud at a distance, and dies away to a feeble wail as they approach. When they are near you, the sound of their wings may be heard, and the flashing lights of their eyes can be seen, like dancing fireflies in the dark. Should you be the happy possessor of a coconut pearl, you are safe, but otherwise the only way to beat them off is to cut at them with a kreese, the blade of which has been rubbed with the juice of a lime. If you see the lights and hear the moaning in front of you, wheel suddenly round, and make a cut in the opposite direction. Burblangs always go by contraries, and are never where they appear to be. So then he goes on about different remedies that you can use to keep yourself safe from the Burblangs. And he talks about how he and the son of one of his friends decided to go and visit the Burblang village. We arrived in sight of the village about 5 o'clock, but Mitali would not approach within half a mile and tried to persuade me not to go nearer. Finding I was determined to go, however, he begged me to take his kriss and a few limes and told me to accept no food unless I first sprinkled it with lime juice, as the Burblangs were in the habit of setting food before strangers, which had the appearance of curried fish, but was in reality human flesh, and should I once eat this, my soul would be destroyed, and I should become a Burblang. He goes to visit it, but he finds that there is nobody there. He goes back to his guide and tells him, and the guide says, oh, this is bad, because what that means is that the Burblangs are out hunting. The sun was setting as we started on our homeward way, and before we had covered half the distance, it was quite dark. There was not a breath of air stirring, and we were in the middle of an open valley with no trees about, when we heard a loud moaning noise like someone in pain. Mitali immediately crouched down in the long grass and pulled me down beside him. He said the Burblangs were coming down the valley, and our only chance was that they might pass us by without seeing us. We lay hidden there while the moaning sound grew fainter, and Mitali whispered that they were coming nearer. Presently the sound died away to a faint wail, and the sound of wings became audible, while a lot of little dancing lights, like fireflies, only reddish, passed over us. I could feel Mitali's grip tighten on my arm, and I felt a nasty, creepy sensation about the roots of my hair. But after the lights had passed, the noise of wings ceased, the moaning grew louder, and Mitali told me they had gone by, and for the time being we were safe. We continued on our way down the valley, and passing an isolated house at some distance from the path, the moaning grew faint again, and Mitali said the Burblangs had certainly got into the house, and he trusted that Hassan, the owner, had a coconut pearl to protect him. We shortly after arrived at the village and were congratulated on our lucky escape. Now I knew Hassan, to whose house the Burblangs had gone, and decided to call on him the next day and see what account he had to give of the night's occurrences. Accordingly, shortly after daybreak, I started off alone as I could get no one to accompany me, and in due course came to Hassan's house. There was no sign of anyone about, so I tried the door, but found it fastened. I shouted several times, but no one answered, so putting my shoulder to the door, I gave a good push, and it fell in. I entered the house and looked round, but could see no one. Going further in, I suddenly started back, for huddled up on the bed with hands clenched, face distorted, and eyes staring as in horror, lay my friend Hassan, dead. I have stated above the facts just as they occurred, and I'm quite unable to give any explanation of them. How do you like that? It's genuinely a story about his encounter with the Burblang. It's made particularly wonderful by, as far as I know, being the only account of the Burblang, although there certainly are other creatures in Filipino folklore that have similar properties. This idea that someone kind of sends out their spirit in a monstrous form to prey on others is one that does turn up. Indeed, I think as we shall see later on in this volume, if you know your way around the Philippines, you may be asking yourself where the dickens is Cagayan Sulu. It's called Mapun, I think. I don't know how to pronounce that. So the Burblang in the Fiend Folio has a lot of the features of the folkloric Burblang, or the Burblang as described by Ethelbert Forbes Skirchley. And so, for example, it has the thing where it sends out an astral form, it has the thing where it eats entrails, it has the thing where it has to eat human flesh every now and again, and it sort of hides its body when it goes out to do that because otherwise it might be vulnerable. Sadly, it doesn't have the thing where it uses its feet as wings, which is kind of a weird image. And sadly, it doesn't have the other very cool part of the Burblang story, which is the idea that As the sound gets fainter, they're getting closer, and if you hear them in front of you, they're behind you. So sort of this idea that Burbalang always goes by contraries. That's a very good fairy tale monster bit, that they always do things backwards. They're like bizarro, I guess. So I think the Burbalang is pretty great. The D&D Burbalang loses some of the charm of it being a person, right? Like, oh, that village is full of Burbalangs. But I guess a lot of those, you know, oh, they're people and they're cannibals and whatever, a lot of that atmosphere is already taken up by ghouls in Dungeons & Dragons, so I guess the Burbalang doesn't want to overlap too much. Overall, I think the Burbalang is pretty great, and I'm particularly fond of that story. So that's about all the time that we have for this episode. Indeed, my self-indulgent old explorer voice has led us to run a little bit over time, but never mind, eh? In our next episode, we're going to be talking about a big frog with glowy eyes, a mean old bird, and a big old slimy worm. So please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.